Talking History on News Talk.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, the brutal and illegal killing of a group of British soldiers trapped behind enemy lines in 1914. Sport and leisure in the Irish country houses in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. The lived experience of British forces in Germany after the Second World War. A county-by-county exploration of this country's natural wonders, clever inventions and historic industries. And to end the show, we'll hear about wild stories from the Irish uplands. Last week, we brought you the life and work of Dvorak, and we explored how his music has provided hope and inspiration over the decades. And if you want to listen back, just go to our website, newstalk.com, or wherever you download your podcasts. But first, the killing of the Iron 12. A new book explores why the German army brutally and illegally executed a group of British soldiers who were trapped behind enemy lines during the retreat to the Marne in 1914. It's called The Killing of the Iron 12, an account of the largest execution of British soldiers on the Western Front in the First World War. It's published in hardback by Pen and Sword Military and costs £19.99 sterling, so about €24. The author is Hedley Malloch. And Hedley, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Very much. Very pleased to talk to you.
This is a story that I think will catch a lot of our listeners by surprise. Can you tell us exactly what happened? These soldiers who were caught behind enemy lines, why they were executed, and the fact that it also included 10 Irishmen.
Yes, they were caught by surprise due to the rapidity of the German advance to the Marne. There were many, many of them. On some accounts, there were hundreds of them who were just left behind the lines. They were taken in by the French in places like around Saint-Quentin and Guise and the forest of Mourmal. And they stayed there. Some tried to make their way back to the UK, others to the Great Britain, rather. Others tried to stay in the hope that the British would come back. I found details of 24 British soldiers executed, including 10 Irishmen. That's 40%. And that's roughly the proportion of Irishmen who were in the British Army in 1914.
And what's interesting is they seem to have made fools, or they seem to have embarrassed the German army for the fact that they had been hiding, and that seems to have played a part in the fact that such drastic measures were taken against them.
In this case, they had. I traced the executions of 24 British soldiers, and in all of these cases, there were local and there were more broader considerations. Here, the local considerations were that the Germans knew that the French village of Yvonne was hiding a number of British and Irish soldiers. And they had been tipped off about this. They had raided the premises they suspected. These were the Loger Mill in Yvonne in the middle of December 1914. But they didn't find them. And they didn't find them because they bungled the raid. They didn't search the premises properly. They didn't guard the back door. Soldiers escaped outside the back door. And they didn't do any checks. So when these soldiers were eventually betrayed in February 1915 and the Germans found them, they were outraged because they had been made to look a group of fools. Here we have some German officers. They'd been made to look a group of fools by some, as they would see them, French peasants, most of whom were women, children, and by a group of British officers, British Army soldiers, who did not have an officer between them. And I think they must have regarded this as an insufferable insult to their pride. Also, the German army operated under a culture whereby local commanders were given a lot of discretion as to how they could handle cases like this. The German army was marked by extreme decentralization, which placed an emphasis on rapid decision-making, few appeals, and one in which mistakes would be forgiven. So the local German commanders had discretion as to how they handled this. They were also paranoid about the question of spying. Most of the soldiers who were caught in this area were shot for spying, although there was little evidence to support the idea that they were, in fact, spies. So these are the local factors that that influenced their decisions, and the broader ones were about the decision-making and the culture of the German army.
And as you show, these were illegal under the various Hague Conventions in 1907. So this is something that Germany had signed up to and now was willfully breaching.
Well, we say Germany signed up to them, but part of the problem rests in the organization structure of the German state and of the German army. The Kaiser signed up for them, but nobody else did. And the Kaiser was responsible for the army, and the army reported to him, and to him alone. There was no civilian oversight of what they did. They didn't go to the Reichstag. So you had decisions like this one being taken without any civilian oversight or without any political input. And this led, as in this case, to a disaster. And it's similar to the Cavell case, which was taken under a similar organization structure. And that, again, was another local decision which led to catastrophic consequences for Germany.
And finally, then, it's interesting, in the course of your research, you've looked at a number of Irish soldiers who were on the run behind enemy lines and some quite extraordinary stories of heroism.
Yes, absolutely. One I came across was Private Phelan, who was in the Royal Army Medical Corps, and he managed to hide in a house in Saint-Quentin, and he integrated so well in to French society that he could live in a common boarding house with German soldiers and in plain sight of these German soldiers and pass himself off as a local. His remarks on his history are quite interesting. He said that if he wants to avoid capture, you had to, first of all, you had to learn to pass yourself off as a local, to look like a local, to walk like a local, and you had to learn the language too. He could do it so well, he even learned a little Flemish. And he got out by passing himself off as a local to such an extent that he could be deported along with the French back to unoccupied France in 1917. There was another one of the great unsung heroes of the war, Private Jameson, Francis Jameson from Dublin, who led a group of 8 to 10 people, and he led them back after living in a hole in the ground for 3 months outside the village of Sarre in northern France. And he showed extraordinary panache, extraordinary leadership skills in getting these men through.
Very good. Well, congratulations on the book. It's called The Killing of the Iron 12, an account of the largest execution of British soldiers on the Western Front in the First World War. It's published in hardback by Pen and Sword Military, the author, Hedley Malik. And Hedley, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you very much indeed.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. Sir Shane Leslie once wrote that country life was entirely organised to give nobility and gentry and demi-gentry a good time. And a new book explores how leisure and sport underpin the social hierarchy of country houses and their local communities in Ireland and Britain in the 19th and 20th centuries. The book is called Sport and Leisure in the Irish and British Country House. It's published in paperback by Four Courts Press and costs €29.95. The editors are Terence Dooley and Christopher Ridgway, and I'm delighted to welcome them both to the show tonight. And Terence, I might begin with you, and I might begin with the purpose of this story. And I suppose the extensive research that went into it, because it really is bringing together a range of brilliant scholars to discuss this interesting area.
Yes, Patrick. Well, the volume is based on papers that were delivered at the 16th Annual Historic Houses Conference held in Maynooth back in May 2018. And the conference theme was sport and leisure in the country house. Now, elite society, as we know, has traditionally, I suppose, been perceived as a leisured one, and rightly so. And they generally did have both time and wealth to indulge in their favourite sports and leisure activities. But there also had to have been, many economic, political and cultural contexts and consequences which we felt required further investigation. And what we would hope is that the essays in the volume prove this point. If you take, for example, Brian Griffin's intriguing chapter on sport and leisure during the famine. It provides, you know, this very original insight as to how sporting events, leisure activities, and even feasting continued by many in the midst of deprivation and hunger. And of course, that wasn't just the aristocracy and the gentry. I mean, the same thing applied for the middle classes as well. So the volume has essays on popular sports such as hunting and racing, but less researched leisure pursuits such as astronomy and scrapbook keeping, for example. And you have Kieran Riley's essay as well that illustrates how, you know, the GAA and the Big House were unlikely allies and bedfellows in the late 19th century.
And you have a very interesting essay yourself on the Big House aristocracy and golf in Ireland.
Yes, I think that probably emerged, Patrick, from my interest, obviously, in the Big House, but also in the controversies of the late 20th and even right up to the present day in terms of the development of domains as golf courses in Ireland. I mean, most people will remember the controversies around the development of Carton, for example. And yet the aristocracy and the wealthier gentry had no issues with developing their domains in the late Victorian and the Edwardian period. And I suppose because many of them were greatly taken by the sport as a new form of leisure for a start. But secondly, and given the economic climate of the time and their own financial difficulties, some were quick to exploit the real estate potential of their land. As the middle classes, especially around industrial Belfast, for example, began to participate more in recreational sport. So a golf course might just be as profitable, if not more profitable, than agricultural rents, and especially if it was tied into the growing tourism industry. I mean, the development of Ryall Port Rush, where Shane Lowry won the British Open last year, is a typical example of this. But there was also, of course, the great political consideration, because golf was being championed by Arthur Balfour, often referred to as Arthur Golfer, because of his obsession with the sport. And when Balfour came to Ireland then as chief secretary, and given the nature of his own politics and his appeal to Ulster unionists and so on, then, golf courses begin to emerge as collaborative efforts between Ulster aristocratic families, the industrial wealth of Belfast, and unionists were latching on to the idea that, I mean, golf courses could also double as unionist recreational clubs.
And Christopher, when we talk about sport and leisure, what do we actually mean by those concepts?
Well, I think with sport, we mean clearly some degree of physical activity, whether it's individual or much more likely a team sport. And it's a kind of muscular pastime, if you like. Leisure, I think, is a more... Well, it's a quieter affair. It's often very more private. So, I mean, in the examples in the volume we've talked about, you have people who are interested in things like astronomy or photography or scholarship, things like that, which are kind of more traditional sort of pursuits of in leisure time, a kind of a hobby, if you like. But I think the kind of division is sort of slightly artificial because they move one into another and they denote a class that has recreational choices because they live an affluent lifestyle and can, as it were, devote their time to things that are not about making a living necessarily.
And the image would be that when it came to the country house, that hunting, horse racing, archery and cricket perhaps would have been the dominant sports. Is that correct?
I think hunting and horse racing very much so. I think cricket, as the 19th century grows, I think other things start to appear in the 19th century, certainly golf, croquet, tennis, things like that, archery, yes. Those sports all become more codified and, as it were, popularly engaged with in the course of the 19th century. And, of course, some of those things like cricket and archery and tennis, I mean, don't necessarily have the same social status as horse racing or hunting, which required much greater outlays of money to be able to afford to do those things.
And Christopher, in terms of the relationship between Ireland and Britain, was it the same thing happening in the country houses in both places, or were you seeing subtle or perhaps not so subtle differences?
In my view, they're pretty much the same, both sides of the water, in fact, that this strata of society is engaged in the same pursuits. And very often they would look at their social calendar either side of the water that would involve things like regattas or horse race meetings that would be key occasions in the social calendar throughout the year. So I don't see a lot of distinction between many of these country house activities. Clearly, there is a difference when you come to things like GAA sports, which are not don't have the same sort of foothold in England as they do in Ireland, obviously. But then equally, you know, people might think that cricket wasn't very popular in Ireland where it was in England. But au contraire, actually, it was very popular in Ireland.
And Terence, can I ask you then about this being part of the legacy of the country house in the 19th and 20th century? And do you see it as how significant a part of that legacy do you see it?
Well, is it from a sporting legacy perspective? I mean, big houses made a contribution to development of many sports that we continue to enjoy today. Up until the late 1980s, most of the former landed class were, I suppose, still administering horse racing in Ireland. Most of the race courses that we visit were developed by them in the 19th century. And I'm thinking in particular of Punchestown and Ferry House and the Curragh. Cricket has made a dramatic comeback in Ireland. It was once more popular than the GAA. I mean, the first cricket club was founded in Ireland in 1825 by Lord Dunlough in Garbally in Galway. Golf courses last year, as I mentioned already, the British Open was won on the Royal Portrush. Many of the golf courses that are still there today were originally domains. Adair will host the Ryder Cup in a couple of years. And what few people realise is that the Earl of Dunraven had a golf course there since he became interested in the sport in the 19th century. But maybe an even more interesting one is the collaboration between landed families and the GAA in the early years of the development of Gaelic games, when they made parts of their lands or even parts of their domains available for playing pitches. And by extension then, when the Irish Land Commission comes in post-independence and begins to acquire domains and untended lands and redistribute them, very often part of this land went to the local GAA club. And that's an area that requires further investigation.
Okay, well, my thanks to both of you for joining me tonight to discuss the book. It's Sport and Leisure in the Irish and British Country House. It's published in paperback by Four Courts Press and costs €29.95. The editors are Terence Dooley and Christopher Ridgway. Delighted they could both join me tonight. And we'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. A new book provides a military and social history of the British forces in Germany, published to coincide with the winding down of the operation in recent months. The book is called British Forces in Germany, The Lived Experience. It's published in hardback by Profile Editions and costs £35 sterling, so about €41. The author is Dr. Peter Johnston. And Peter, you're very welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
I think for Irish listeners, there'll be a certain amount of surprise at the fact that there were British soldiers in Germany up until relatively recently.
I mean, I think it's a surprise for everybody. It's a surprise whichever side of the Irish Sea you're on, to be honest. The number of people I've spoken to in my role at the National Army Museum about this and said, you know, did you know that the British Army was still here well after the Second World War? And they're absolutely astounded by it. But, you know, from in 1945, when the Army first got into Germany, it was very clear that they were going to have to stay there a long time. You know, on the 8th of May, Field Marshal Montgomery actually says, you know, he said, we've now won the German war. Let us now win the peace. And for him, the way that was going to be done was by having British soldiers stationed in Germany. Now, Montgomery thought they'd be there for about 50 years, and as it turns out, they're there about 75 years, so a little bit longer than the original estimate. But no, it's absolutely amazing that the army still continues to be there. And then it's really when you delve into the history of this and you see this really changing relationship between the army and Germany, you actually begin to understand why they've stayed there for so long.
And you get a good insight into the major political events of this period, from the Berlin airlift to the erection of the Berlin Wall to the fall of it.
Yeah, thank you. I mean, obviously, the soldiers who are in Germany at this time, you know, the British soldiers, there's also Canadians there as well. Obviously, there's many Irish soldiers serving in the British Army at this period, too. You know, they are witnesses to history. You know, they're on the front line of the Cold War. and these amazing huge geopolitical events that we know so well, you know, the Berlin Wall going up, the invasion of Czechoslovakia. You know, these guys are living it and they're there, and it is completely dominating their way of life, their daily existence. And it's dominating not only for them, but also for their families. I mean, what a lot of people didn't realize is, in as early as 1946, the British Army says, you know, yes, this is actually Germany's going to be a home posting. You know, serving in Germany is going to be exactly the same as serving in Aldershot or Catterick or somewhere like that. And so your family can come and be here with you. So people's spouses and their children went out too. And obviously that means they needed a whole level of their own infrastructure. So you get these schools being built, these shops, these supermarkets. And actually you have these little tiny pockets of Britain, therefore, springing up all over the British zone of well, what is then Western Germany, and obviously in West Berlin as well. So it's this cultural occupation as much as a military one.
And that's really what's so fascinating in it, that it's the social history dimension that you see this integration of the troops with what's going on around them.
Absolutely. And, you know, initially there are rules to prevent them from integrating with the local Germans. You know, non-fraternization is punishable by a whole series of things, you know, verging from docking of pay to being imprisoned for short periods of time in the army disciplinary system. But as the decades wear on, and in particular after the collapse of the Berlin Wall and, you know, and the reunification of Germany and the reorientation about what Germany means to the British Army, with this far greater level of integration between British soldiers and their German neighbours, you know, they move from being sort of the occupied to being good friends.
And in terms of things that surprised you when you were researching this book, was there anything that stood out?
I think probably the thing that surprised me the most was just how influential the Cold War was actually for the British Army. You know, it's, when we talk about the Cold War, it's very difficult to break beyond our understanding about what it is. You know, this is a face-off between the two great powers, the two ideological systems of capitalist West versus the communist East. And, you know, we understand that in latter days, we understand that that never turned hot. And yes, there was fighting in proxy in it in places like Korea and Vietnam. But that real sort of central confrontation, which took place in Europe, never really came about. And actually, I think that sometimes when you delve into it, you realise how close it came on many levels, and how seriously people thought it might come. You know, speaking to the soldiers who lived in the shadow of the imminent threat of nuclear war, you understand how seriously they took things like training. You know, they were training to fight a war that very few of them actually expected to survive, and it bred this unique and strange culture, these rituals, these ideas that are completely unique, I think, certainly to the history of the British Army. And a level of behaviour and a calendar of events, the only equivalent I can really find is something like India and the British Army's long service in India, which is in itself quite amazing. And that was certainly something that really surprised and thrilled me when I was researching the book. And I hope it comes across to the readers too.
And I think it's a book that people will be interested in and enjoy because of those social, political and kind of cultural dimensions.
I really hope so. I mean, when I set out to write this, it was very much, I wanted to do justice to the story, and I wanted to tell it from the perspective of the people who were actually there. You know, as a historian, that's the thing that interests me is people's understandings of these huge global events. You know, how is it perceived at the grassroots? How does that influence you? And that's something that my research has always looked at. And so in this book, as I say, it was about saying, you know, okay, so the Berlin Wall goes up, and we understand that, and we're very familiar with Kennedy visiting Berlin and being on the platform and looking over the Berlin Wall. We're very famous with Reagan, you know, telling Mr. Gorbachev to tear down this wall, you know, all these sorts of things, these huge, great players on the international scene. But what was it like for an ordinary soldier, you know, a 19, 20-year-old or a young soldier and his family? What was it like for the spouse and the children of soldiers to live in the shadow, to be witness to these huge global events? And yet, to be honest, be a story that lots of people have forgotten. You know, when we talk about the story of the British Army, often it's a story of campaigns and conflict. And yet the Cold War was a victory for the British Army without a shot really being fired, which in itself is quite tremendous. So how you tell that story was a bit of a challenge, but I really enjoyed it, and I hope the readers enjoy it too.
Okay, well, Peter, congratulations on the book. It's called British Forces in Germany, The Lived Experience. It's published in hardback by Profile Editions and costs £35 sterling, so about €41. The author, Peter Johnston. And Peter, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it. Thanks a lot.
We'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. A new book, Ingenious Ireland, is a unique study of this country's natural wonders, clever inventions, and historic industries. And it brings the reader on a fascinating county-by-county tour of Ireland with details of what to see and places to visit. It's published in paperback by Four Courts Press in a new edition and costs €19.95. The author is Mary Mulvihill, a pioneering science writer and broadcaster who sadly passed away in 2015. And to discuss the book, I'm delighted to welcome Cormac Sheridan and Brian Trench to the show. You're very welcome.
Thank you.
Cormac, can I begin with you? How did you get to know Mary and her work?
I got to know Mary herself in the early 1990s. I was just beginning my own career as a freelance science journalist, and Mary was the then co-editor of Technology Ireland, and she played a very, very important role in kind of nurturing the next generation. When I say the next generation, she wasn't that much older than I was, but her accomplishments far exceeded mine. She was really one of the kind of standout people in science journalism and science communication, even at that point, which is relatively early in her career. I'm talking about the early 1990s at this point.
And she seems to have had not only a brilliant career, but also a very innovative career, because she was involved in things, not only journalism, but themed walking tours, apps, audio guides, that she was at the forefront of new developments.
Mary was almost kind of like a one-woman Jean in terms of science communication. She really did plough her own furrow. She had a very distinctive take on what it was that she wanted to do and how it was that she was going to go about it. She really was an original. An awful lot of journalism of any description can be quite reactive. You respond to whoever are considered the newsmakers of the day and you get on with reporting what they do. Mary did a bit of that with plenty of good professional verve, but what really grabbed her were her own interests, and this great project of hers was Ireland and trying to understand Ireland at multiple intellectual levels. And that's kind of the direction that she took in the mid and latter parts of her career.
And that brings us to this book. And she seems to have had a particular ability and talent when it came to geology, and she was able to discuss it in very easy to understand language.
The more I read the book, because it's one of those books you dip into and dip out of continually, the more I'm impressed with her ability to take something, one of those difficult to grasp kind of subjects like geology. My own scientific background has very much a sort of a reductionist type of an approach. Mary was wonderful at this sort of synthetic gathering in of information. Geology, and also it also had ecology in a similar fashion. Wonderful at just taking complex subjects that require a kind of a lifetime's accrual of knowledge to properly gather them in. She was very accomplished at doing that, I think.
And she seems to have been quite brilliant at uncovering and recovering all these layers that might have been lost. And you've written about that before, about how this was one of her great skills. And you see that in the book. So let's talk about how does she do this in the book?
She starts the book with this magnificent set piece, kind of standalone essay at the start, that looks at the sort of the geological origins of this island that we call Ireland. She starts from there and traces the geological development of this island and then the ecological development of this island. And she sort of sets the stage. It's almost like this prehistory of the country. And then she lashes into the main body of the work, as it were, you know. And I actually feel one of the things I was thinking of on the way in here was that how one of the great achievements, I think, of Ingenious Ireland is how she sort of embraces the great Anglo-Irish scientific tradition and urges us implicitly, there's no great rhetoric around this, but she urges us implicitly to take ownership of that and to enjoy it and to see it as part of our heritage. And I'm figuring that actually when you think as she did on sort of geological timescales, 800 years of colonialist oppression mightn't be too big a deal in the overall scheme of things.
And some wonderfully colourful stories as well in the book.
Oh, they're so rich. I mean, I adore the little nuggets. I mean, she deals with the big set pieces very well, like Ardna Crusha, like the great innovations that came out of our universities. But I love the little sort of, the little small anecdotes, the little biographical sketches. There's one character called Peter Freyr from Galway, who I just think he was just, had such an extraordinary life. She calls it the little section, the Prince of the Prostate. So he removed a bladder stone from the Raja of Rampur in India in 1888, for which she awarded the princely sum of £10,000. He then created a new surgical procedure for removing the prostate gland, and he would perform demonstrations of this technique while giving simultaneous running commentary in English, French and Hindustani.
Very good. Brian, when you read the book, you realise how natural history and science history really doesn't feature as much in Irish historical studies as it should.
Yes, and I mean, you'd obviously, as a professional historian, be more tuned into this than I am. I come at this from an interest in science communication, and I shared that with Mary, and I was a colleague and a friend and indeed a teacher of hers. And although this isn't a work exclusively of history, and as you've already been discussing, there's geology, there's natural history, there's topography and so on in there as well. But among the nuggets, like the one that Cormac just referred to, there are lots of little historical biographies. And I still marvel at how Mary managed to string all this stuff together. You know, she was writing in and assembling her information in the late 1990s when the World Wide Web was still a relatively new thing and Google probably didn't exist. Is that right? Yeah, it wouldn't have existed at the time. So, you know, she would have had to have gathered lots of scraps of information on paper and from various sources. And she wouldn't have had any general history of science in Ireland on which to call. There are and there were, just at the time that she was writing, beginning to be biographical studies and a couple of institutional studies. But they're scattered, fragmented. There was no real centre of history of science in Ireland other than in Queen's University in Belfast. So she had to really make it herself. And I still, to this day, don't know how she managed to put together, amount to a kind of history of science in Ireland.
And from the hundreds of gems in the book, do you have any favourites?
No, it's a bit like your child asking you what was the best bit of the film. But I don't, because in fact, every time I dip in, I find something else. You know, so just coming here to a building called Marconi House, I had to look at what she got about Marconi. And of course, Marconi's Irish dimension is really interesting. And it's there at some length. And then there are lots of others that are just there as little snippets that could be the basis of a whole book. Like she has a paragraph that I just happened on this morning where she's referring to Swift and Swift satirizing science in Gulliver's Travels. And then she has a little paragraph of other literary figures who address science in one way or the other. And there's a whole thesis in there that's hinted at and that hasn't been written and that's well worth writing. I grew up in sight and sound of the viaduct over the Boyne in Drogheda. We used to go up and play on the railway there. I don't know how we got away with it. But anyway, and I suppose I never fully realised just what an amazing thing this was. And it's recognised internationally. And she starts her section on County Louth writing about the viaduct in Drogheda as a engineering triumph. And many years after I'd left Drogheda and before this book appeared, I was in the Musée des Arts et Métiers in Paris, and the arts in that context refers to technology. And there was a model of the bridge in my hometown because it was recognised internationally as an engineering triumph. And the person who worked on it was a man with the wonderful name of Bindon Blood Stoney. And she then develops the story of Bindon Blood Stoney, who had almost more significant engineering achievements in the development of the Port of Dublin and the development of an instrument called the Diving Bell, which is still there and can be visited, and after whom Stony Road is named in East Wall. And one of the things that's worth thinking about is how few roads, streets, places or statues there are to commemorate these ingenious people that Mary's writing about.
Okay, so this new edition, I think, is a wonderful tribute to her remarkable work.
It certainly is, and it puts me in mind that there's more that could be done, you know, with the technologies that we have that she didn't have. To translate this into an app on a smartphone tied in with GPS coordinates and allow people, possibly through crowdsourcing, through a kind of wiki project, to add in their own pieces, because there's so much more. It's infinite, the things that could be added to this, or that could be spun out of this, where she has brief mentions of things that could be elaborated and illustrated. And this book really stands up nearly 20 years after its first publication. But there's clearly a bigger work or an extension of this work that could be done by other means.
Okay, well, Cormac Sheridan, Brian Trench, thank you so much for joining me tonight to discuss this remarkable book and indeed the remarkable author, Mary Mulvihill. It's called Ingenious Ireland. It's published in paperback by Four Courts Press in a new edition and costs €19.95. The author, as I say, Mary Mulvihill, and I think we all miss her and her remarkable contribution. Okay, we'll be back with more Talking History on News Talk right after this.
Talking History on News Talk.
Well, welcome back to Talking History. No matter where you go, the Irish uplands have been loaded with history and legend, while also being lauded in song and story. And through the ages, they've been intertwined with the course of Irish history, bringing together rebels, rogues, and revered mystics. And their story has now been told in a new book, Wild Stories from the Irish Uplands. It's published in paperback by Curragh Books and costs €14.99. The author is John G. O'Dwyer. And John, you're very welcome to the show tonight.
Thank you very much, Patrick, indeed, for having me on.
I'm intrigued. You describe St. Patrick as Ireland's first hill walker. Why is that?
Probably because I'm a hill walker myself and I'm slightly biased. But, you know, I think it was, of course, I think the people who wanted to promote Patrick, I think, recognised the importance of high places. So they endowed him continually with looking down from above. So if you look at right through Ireland, you have Slemish. You will have the Hill of Slane. Then he goes on down to the Rock of Cashel, where, of course, he baptises the king there and probably have gotten his head chopped off because he actually pushed his spear at the end of his staff through the foot of the king, but the king thought it was part of the ceremony. So in Meath, we have loaded him with high places onto Ard Patrick, the high place of Patrick in Limerick, where a monastic site developed. And then, of course, more famously, up to Maumain, where he went through the pass from the Giles country into Connemara. I don't think he went any farther. That's the myth, that Connemara was too wet, so he just blessed it and went back. And then Kirkpatrick as well as that. And then, of course, built a cathedral on a hill, which is now the city of Armagh. So I think I have good justification for that.
So this is, in a way, a study of the Irish mountains and the history that's connected to them.
Yes, I think there is. The thing is, the Irish mountains have been accessible. If you take the Alps, the High Alps, I mean, no, people didn't get to the top of Mount Blanc a bit over 200 years ago. But the Irish mountains have been lower and more accessible, and therefore they have always been, I think, part of Irish history, part of the psyche as well. When I was writing about this, what fascinated me was Tom Barry, when I was writing about him and how he fought in the hills of West Cork. But as well as that, then when he was in Gormanstown and then he escaped, he was interned there and he escaped from there, how uncomfortable he was with the people in North Leinster. He didn't feel happy until he managed to make his way back into Tipperary. Then he was among the hill country and he was among his own people. So they have a special place, a rugged individualism of these kind of people. And of course, against British rule, they were always the ones that held out longest.
And let's talk about some of those stories. So, for example, the 9 Years' War might have been avoided if Hugh O'Donnell had perished while he was trekking through the mountain.
Yes, all we needed was Dublin Kerry Mountain Rescue team maybe there or whatever, the two of them. But if he had perished there, that's right, and there was Art O'Neill as well as that who was with him, he almost perished. I mean, he was unconscious. Had he died there, he would have managed. It was a huge headache for Queen Elizabeth that would have been avoided, but he managed to make it. He lost some toes and that kind of thing, and that happens right up to the present day. Of course, you can get frostbite as well, and of course we've global warming at the moment, but the issue then was global dimming, and we were in the little ice age during the medieval period, so they escaped at the worst possible time and had to make their way in a blizzard. Incredible feat of navigation and endurance to make it to Glenmalure through the Wicklow Mountains in those conditions.
And speaking of the Wicklow Mountains, they became very important for the rebels of the 1798 rebellion afterwards.
I think they were, particularly Michael Dwyer. Now, I think this is probably your area of very much deeper knowledge than I have on this. But the thing is, Michael Dwyer held out for so long. Now, I don't think he would have made any huge difference to British rule in Ireland, but it was hugely symbolic. And
after the crushing of the 1798 rising, I think he was a symbolic symbol of hope. But he's a fascinating character. Rags to riches, right, and riches and rags again. I mean, started with nothing, became a rebel, was then transported to Australia, became a reasonably well-off farmer, then fell foul of the governor, Captain Bligh, who was the governor of Sydney, not known for, you know, being nice to Irish rebels. But then he was transported to an island off the coast, a penal island. Old Bligh then is the colonists overthrow him. He's brought back, eventually becomes chief of police, and then there's a sad end to it. He buys a pub, becomes his own best customer, and dies in poverty. You know, a novelist couldn't make it up.
You also have a fascinating insight into the Irish Civil War and what happened to the Republican leader Liam Lynch, because his death took place on an Irish mountain, and there was a lot of eyewitness accounts, and you capture that brilliantly.
Well, thank you very much for that. I certainly tried. I found that the most fascinating of the whole thing, because I was, you know, reading the military war records first, and then I suddenly discovered everybody's talking about this. Has anybody gone out and followed his footsteps? So as a hill walker, I went out and did that. And what I found was, I thought, you know, people, these records would be embellished. But every single detail, from the house, the Houlihan house, the river where he escaped, the river which he escaped up to, which was too deep for the Free State soldiers to shoot at him, rivers emerged as the soil becomes less as you go up the mountain. Eventually they are forced out, they run a few hundred metres, and where the monument is, as far as I could possibly see, that was exactly the place you would expect him to be shot. So that was absolutely, fascinating, and it was of course such a pathos in the account, because he was shot by Larry Clancy, whose own brother had been killed by the Black and Tans. And then when Lynch lay dying, this was a former comrade of his, and he pulled out a silver pen and handed it to him in a kind of a token of regard. Such pathos, it's incredible. So, the great tragedy of Irish history, of course, the Civil War.
And you have other brilliant stories throughout the book. For example, the Abbey building of the Cistercians.
Yeah, absolutely incredible. I mean, when the Cistercians came to Ireland, what a change. Up to that, really the only big buildings we would have had in the Irish landscape were some Celtic round towers. Monasteries weren't very big. And then these great Cistercian abbeys came in, starting at Mellifont, Kilcooley, Holy Cross, right over the country. But the Cistercians were brilliant. You didn't find them out far west. The land wasn't good enough. They were great farmers. They traded in wool. They became extremely wealthy. But this incredible thing, I think of, the awestruck locals as these Europeans came in and built these great abbeys. And then the employment, the people who worked there, who were around it, the people who came in then all the way from Wales to work in these abbeys, how the Normans had transformed Ireland. I think the Cistercians were fantastic. Then they were kicked out of Ireland because of their wealth. And then there is their rebirth again in the most unlikely circumstances, when they are actually expelled from France and they come back to Mount Mellery Abbey in County Waterford. Fascinating story.
And that was some wild stories from the Irish uplands, bringing our show to an end tonight. My thanks to everyone who put tonight's show together, Susan Cattle, my producer, and David Nolan on sound. So join us next week on News Talk. We've been talking history. Good night.